Let's turn to the chapter that is before us tonight. It is Genesis 26. And this is one of the lesser known chapters of Genesis. It has to do with Isaac, who is one of the lesser known of the patriarchs, probably the least known. And he's the least known because there's the least amount of information about him. This is the one chapter that is devoted mostly to events in his life. And as we get into it, I think we're going to see it's not ultimately about him, but about how the Lord was using him to carry on the covenant blessing and setting up for other things that he was doing down the road. It really is hard to know sometimes what to make of some of these characters. We know so little of their lives and understand so little of their backgrounds, and we don't want to make too much of statements that are made, but he is very much of a transitional character. And I think by way of application, we need to be prepared for the fact that in the plan of God, there are major characters and there are minor characters. And that God chooses many people, not necessarily to have very prominent and large roles in his work, but to be kind of people passing on the baton, kind of transitional figures who are carrying on something that went on before and who are continuing the race and carrying on the message so that a later generation can perhaps do greater things for the Lord in the future. And that is very much the sense that you get about this man, Isaac. I've entitled this tonight, Transferred Blessing, because in fact this man was like a conduit who was picking out the blessing of the covenant from Abraham. And primarily what we have about him in this chapter is that he's continuing the covenant line, the covenant blessing, and passing it on to the next generation. And as we look at that, I think we'll see some really encouraging things about the Lord and his work, about our own role in that, and learn some valuable lessons as well. Last time we introduced this generation and talked a little bit about Isaac, but as well about his wife, Rebekah, and their two sons, Jacob and Esau, some truths that were being set up there as we move forward in the story of Genesis. And when we come to chapter 26, basically the way it divides up is geographically. I want to point that out to you. If you look at chapter 26, verse 1, it says, Isaac, there toward the end of the verse, Isaac went to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. So he's at that location. Eventually, he gets kind of kicked out of that area. And if you look at the end of verse 16, Abimelech ends up saying to him, go away from us, for you are much mightier than we. And so, verse 17, Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. So he's moving now out of the city into the outlying areas of the valley. And that gives you the setting for that second scene. Well, so things take place there. And then you come to verse 23, and you are at the third location, and we find there that from the valley of Gerar, he went up to a place called Beersheba. And that introduces for us the third shift and the third scene. So the passage divides up according to those locations. And something happens in each of those locations, reference to these Philistines. Philistines, they don't conjure up very warm and fuzzy feelings for you to think about the Bible, Bible history. But in fact, this chapter is all about Isaac's relationship to the Philistines, certain encounters he had with them, some good, some bad, and how all of that connects with God's covenant with this line of the patriarchs. And what we'd like to do tonight is walk through each of those sections. I'm going to give you a little heading for each of them, and then try here again at the end to bring it all together and see how this all contributes to the story of the covenant and to our own story as the people who, in this time in the program of God, are experiencing the covenant blessing and carrying that on to later generations. We're seeing in various ways how God is passing on to this man so much of what he had promised to Abraham, and how he is setting up for Isaac to pass it on to his sons after him. And that happens really very quickly as you come to the next chapter. What's going on here in this first section, which takes place in the city of Gerar there with the Philistines? I'm calling these 16 verses Blessing Endangered, Blessing Endangered by Faithless Deception. In other words, God is setting out to bless, but because of some poor choices on the part of Isaac, it seems that there is a threat that is calling into question whether or not, in fact, he is going to carry on the promise. And actually, the threat has to do with his wife, who's going to be the one through whom Jacob and Esau would be born. Actually, it seems that having introduced us to those sons, Jacob and Esau, in this chapter, we're kind of stepping back to an earlier stage. Remember, there were 20 years there where they were married before the boys were born? And this seems to be a flashback, and one of the reasons we come to that conclusion is that probably he would not have been successful deceiving the Philistines about his relationship with Rebekah for a long time, as the text says, if there had been two little boys running around. And it seems to me that having given you a survey of the family and some of the big ideas there, now you are given this window into some key events that took place before all of that. And it is not a positive scene overall as far as Isaac is concerned. He is setting up here a threat to the promise. Blessing endangered by faithless deception. And what we're going to find here is that all over this chapter, there are all kinds of allusions to Isaac's father, Abraham. In fact, one book I read suggested this chapter could be entitled Abraham 2, as though it were the sequel to a movie about Abraham. Or maybe Abraham Jr., because in many ways, this is the story of Abraham all over again. And each of these sections actually starts out with some very obvious link back to Abraham to remind you of all kinds of things that already took place. And in some cases, we're not going to take the time to look at all the verses, but it's almost verbatim. It's almost verbatim an echo of earlier events if you read back beginning in chapter 12. So let's read on into chapter 26. It says, there was a famine in the land besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. Does that ring a bell? I mean, the text tells you this was like the one that took place during the time frame of Abraham, which goes back to chapter 12. And that explicit link with Abraham's time and what he did going on to Egypt is going to introduce us here to the story. Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. And there's all kind of interesting connections there, because on the one hand, Abraham did go to Egypt, and he is being told not to. If you remember back the story, that was one of the lowest points of Abraham's life. He gets into that whole mess with Pharaoh back there. But actually, the story had begun with the Lord telling Abraham to go somewhere from Ur over to Canaan to the land that I'm going to show you. And now the Lord says to him, don't go anywhere. Just kind of stay here in the land, and I'm going to give you this land someday. And all of that is intended to bring up in your mind some of those key events and some of those key ideas from the life of Abraham. These two are being linked very closely, and you're asking questions now. Well, the reason Abraham went down to Egypt was because he didn't have any food. So if Isaac stays in this area during this famine, what's going to happen? How is the Lord going to protect him? How is he going to survive? How is the promise going to continue? Well, the Lord goes on in the next few verses to get quite specific about what he intends to do with this man. He says, verse 3, sojourn in this land, and I will be with you, and will bless you. Remember that the word blessing is a key word in Genesis. I will bless you, for to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands, and in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. There's an example where, almost verbatim, you find the Lord saying to Isaac what he had said to his father Abraham. And these are not statements just pulled out of the air, just to fill up space. This is very specific selection of God from all of the promises that the Lord had made to Abraham. You may or may not remember that when we looked at the Abrahamic covenant, we tried to boil down the many promises that God made to Abraham under three headings. One of them was, Abraham, you're going to have a lot of kids someday, the seed. And if those seed, if those children, if those people are going to make their way forward and have a ministry, they're going to need to have somewhere to live. And so I'm going to promise you a land that is going to be their possession permanently. And even though I want to bless them in those ways, the reason that I'm doing that is so that they might be a means of blessing all families of the earth. The seed, the land, and the universal blessing. Those are the three main components of the Abrahamic covenant. And did you notice all of them come up here? Those are the three things the Lord is promising to do now with this man, Isaac, as well. There is that repetition of the great and central promises of the Abrahamic covenant. The seed, the land, and the broader ministry of being a blessing redemptively to all families of the earth. Now, you may remember as well that when we were talking about the Abrahamic covenant, there was a big discussion about whether the Abrahamic covenant is conditional or unconditional. And I hope you remember the right answer to that. The right answer is yes. Because initially it seems to be that the covenant was conditional. That God, first of all, called this man out of Ur. He had to go and take possession, as it were, of God's promises in the new land. And there were some other commandments along the way, not the least of which was to be willing to sacrifice his son in chapter 22. And this man was put through a series of tests. And when that's all over, through that whole process, the Lord says, all right, in response to your faith, you obey. And in response to that, I'm going to go ahead and confirm this covenant for your descendants. And what was originally for Abraham, a conditional covenant, because by the grace of God he met the conditions, now becomes an unconditional covenant for future generations. But actually, it turns out it's not even that simple. Because if later generations are to personally enjoy their own part in history of the Abrahamic covenant, there are going to be conditions placed upon them too. And even though God is committed to the descendants of Abraham as a whole, the fact is that individual groups of those people, individual generations of those people, may disqualify themselves from enjoying their own part on the earth in those blessings by their neglecting the Lord, not believing the promises, not obeying the commandments, so that we can speak of certain conditions that even Isaac has to meet. And God wants him to know about that at the front end, which is why he says in the verse that we haven't read yet, verse 5, I'm going to do these things because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Let me clarify. We're not talking here about Abraham somehow being saved by works. We understand he was saved by faith. Genesis 15 made that point very clear. We're not talking here about Abraham's personal salvation. We're talking about his role, the role that God gave him to play in the ongoing program of building up the people of God and bringing in the Messiah and bringing in the kingdom of God on earth. He had a part to play, and in a sense, it was contingent upon him. Thankfully, he obeyed the Lord. The Lord gave him grace to do that, and Isaac is reminded about that here at the get-go. So that he would be aware, look, I've got a part to play too. There's a bit of pressure on me. I'm the guy now. Abraham is gone. I am the key player, humanly speaking, in this process. There is a weight of responsibility on me. And the Lord says, now your father obeyed, and a number of things have happened. Now you think about what I'm going to be requiring of you in your lifetime. Well, what's going to happen? Look at verse 6. So Isaac, having moved to Gerar, now settles down there. That was a good thing, because the Lord said, don't go into Egypt, stay here. So he obeyed, as far as that goes. But, verse 7, when the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, she is my sister. For he feared to say, my wife, thinking lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. Does that sound familiar? Abraham did the same thing twice. In chapter 12 and chapter 21. But at least with Abraham saying it, there was a measure of truth behind it, because Sarah was his half-sister, and there is no relationship that close between these two. I don't know, maybe he was using the word sister in a very broad sense because of the fact that she came over there from Mesopotamia and from his original ancestors and so forth, but the pretty generous definition and pretty sly move on his part. And here, even though he took the first step correctly in obeying the Lord and staying there, as if to say, God, I'm going to trust you to provide me food during this famine, evidently he was not willing to trust the Lord about other things, about sparing his life and protecting his marriage and keeping those men away. And he follows in his father's footsteps. And it seems to me that given everything that Isaac must have known at this point, if anything, he is even more to blame than his father was. Because he had this track record of how God had supplied for his parents. I am sure he heard the stories that we read in those other chapters of Genesis time and time again about the angels coming, about God promising his own birth, about the Lord speaking directly to Abraham, about what God did to Sodom and Gomorrah, about the battle that was won against the enemies of Lot and so forth. I'm sure he heard those stories growing up, and he could sing by heart as far as God's faithfulness. Probably Abraham would have shared with him his failures. I would hope so, that he recounted the story of these kinds of mistakes that he made and how the Lord in mercy forgave him and worked through all of that anyway. And remember, Isaac was the one who came this close to being killed by his father. And as that knife was raised, the angel appears and stops him. And the angel also directs Abraham's attention over to that ram that God had put there and prepared to be sacrificed in the place of Isaac. The point is, Isaac heard all these things and he saw many of them with his own eyes. And here he is at a difficult time in life, and he fails. And he is not making the choice to trust the Lord about protecting his life and keeping him in relationship with his wife. Well, what's going to happen? really many of the same things that happened with Abraham. It goes on to say in verse 8, when he had been there a long time, so he pulled this off for a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. Probably your translation doesn't say laughing. It says something like sporting or maybe even caressing. It's an interesting thing here that the same root off of which Isaac's name is built is used here, translated laughing. And it's almost as though it says, when he saw Isaac, Isaacing. It's a participle from the verb that means to laugh. And different ways to translate it. I don't think this is really the best. I think it has more the idea of playing. That is one of the ways that it can be translated here. But it seems to me there's a deliberate echo to that whole story about where his name came from in the first place. Because it came from the fact that his mother had laughed in disbelief at the promise of God that he would be born. And yet the Lord turned all that around, and the word laugh is used once again to speak of the joy that his parents had when he was born. And now all of that perhaps comes back to his conscience as he is caught playing, sporting with his wife out in public. And he is caught. And it says that Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, she is your wife. How then could you say, 'She is my sister'?" Isaac said to him, "Because I thought, lest I die because of her." Abimelech said, "What is this that you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, "Whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." And what ends up happening there is very much what happened to Abraham before, that godless people end up rebuking the people of God. And sometimes don't lost people have higher standards, or at least are aware of the kinds of standards that Christians are supposed to live by. And sometimes out of their own mouths, they are rebuking us, and things are coming out of their mouths that we are convicted by. And he is demonstrating really a greater concern for people than Isaac did. He says, "Look, you would have brought guilt upon me." Do you suppose Isaac would have thought anything about the potential, "Hey, my life is at stake, but what am I doing to them? What I'm doing to them is putting them in a position where one of them might have committed adultery and brought guilt upon them from the Lord." And apparently Isaac just wasn't thinking at that level. And he ends up rebuked by this idol-worshipping pagan man. And so he issues this warning to his people, "Leave this guy, leave his wife alone. And there's a death threat to anybody who interferes." Well, what's the Lord going to do? "You rascal. You cheat. You liar." I think probably Isaac has been rebuked enough already to get the point. And God doesn't have to beat him over the head with it, because this pagan man had already brought him under conviction. Amazing what the Lord does next. Look at verse 12. "And Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold. The Lord blessed him, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy." Unbelievable mercy on the part of God. That instead of rebuking him and rejecting him and jumping all over him, the response from the Lord is just more blessing. And the Lord realizes there is more at stake than Isaac's own personal life. He realizes that the future of the promise is at stake, and in his grace, he forgives his sin, and he carries on the program to where he begins to fulfill some of the promises that he had made at the beginning of the chapter about blessing, and particularly in a material way. It wasn't like, you know, he had a good season. He ends up, in addition to dealing with sheep and animals and so forth, he ends up as well becoming a farmer, which, as I recall, we don't have any record of regarding his father. And in the same year that those things happened about his wife, he ends up reaping 100-fold. The Lord blesses him, and he becomes extraordinarily wealthy. Isn't that just like the Lord? And we have, I think, from time to time in the series, reminded ourselves of what John 1 says about the coming of Christ and applying in so many other ways that from God we just receive grace instead of grace. One wave of grace comes, and as if that weren't enough, the Lord just showers us with an even greater display of His grace. That's what we're seeing here reflected in this man's life. Well, things get really interesting now. Because the question is, how are the Philistines going to respond to that? And what you want to remember throughout this business about the Philistines is that at the beginning, God says, the goal here is to use you to bless the nations. My purpose in blessing you is to make of you an instrument to spread redemptive blessing to all the nations. Well, this whole chapter is about Abraham or Isaac interacting with one of those nations. And you're asking yourself, is there going to be blessing that's spilled over on them? Is somehow he going to be a conduit of bringing them blessing? Well, initially, the answer is no. Because, as we read on in verse 14, he had possession of the flocks and herds and many servants, so that the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father. There had been a peace treaty with these people, between these people and Abraham. He was dead, so they forget about the treaty. So now they are envying him, and they are stopping up those wells that Abraham had originally dug and claimed for himself. And Abimelech finally says to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." And what is happening there is a bit of a negative on the way to the resolution of the story, that this blessing from God prompts envy. And instead of these people being blessed, in essence, they are cursing him. And you're asking, well, you know, this cannot be the end of the story with these Philistines. Something's got to happen here if this covenant is going to be fulfilled. And that tension is what is going to become the focal point of the rest of the story. How is Abraham's relationship with the Philistines going to go on from here? Or Isaac's relationship with the Philistines? Well, you're going to have to read the rest of it. We'll do that, but let me just share one word of application about what we have seen so far. This comes from Bruce Waltke's. We look back on some of the struggles in Isaac's life to this point. Waltke writes, "Isaac shares some of his father's weaknesses, but like his father, he does not allow his failures permanently to damage his faith. And by way of application, the bearers of Christ's kingdom are sometimes strong, and you see him make a right choice, and he's going to make some other good choices here, but also they're sometimes weak. Every character is mixed. The faithful celebrate God's grace and are not overcome with self-guilt or destroyed by self-contempt." Really is encouraging how the Lord, in his patience, works with these men and matures them through trials and teaches them through their failures. There really is a great deal of hope that's extended to us, even this one chapter. Well, he was basically evicted at the end of that first scene. And so he's got to move. He's got to find somewhere else to live. Scene 2 takes us out to the valley, beginning in verse 17. And I'm calling this blessing embraced by peaceful endurance. We talked about the blessing being threatened by his faithless deception. Now it is blessing embraced by peaceful endurance. And let's take a look at some of these verses here. It starts out really the same way that the other passages started, by reminding you and connecting you back to Abraham. So, verse 17, Isaac departed from there, and he encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water that had been dug in the days of Abraham his father, which the Philistines had stopped after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the names that his father had given them. So right away, you're intended to think about Abraham and the fact that these are wells that are being redug, and certain of those issues from the life of Abraham being pulled forward now into the life of Isaac. Where is this all going? Well, again, he begins to face some difficulty, some opposition. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of spring water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they contended with him. And the word Esek means contention. Verse 21. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that also. So he called its name Sitna. And the word Sitna has to do with enmity, and it's intended to memorialize the quarrel that took place over that one. Very frustrating kind of situation. Maybe you can think of times in your life where you have worked hard over something, and by all rights, it should have been yours, and you should have been able to keep it and enjoy it, and somebody comes along and takes it away from you. And somebody comes along and claims it for their own, and maybe through deception, they are taking away the fruit of your labor. How do you respond to that? Well, one way to respond is to point out what you did, and to bring out the paperwork, and to hire a lawyer, and to really get into it with them. And you would have a case. And whether because God had promised this to him, or whether because Abraham had dug them originally, or whether because he dug these new ones, Isaac could have put on the gloves and could have really gone after these people to claim what was rightfully his. But he didn't. And that's why I'm talking here about peaceful endurance, because his response to that repeated opposition was not self-defense. It was not standing up for his rights, like, "You owe me this. This belongs to me. I dug this. God promised this to me." None of that. He just packs up and he moves on. And he puts up with this kind of mistreatment. I think he's learned a lesson from the last scenario, where he was taking matters into his own hands to protect what was his. Now he is just taking the hands off and saying, "That's all right, you can have it." Why? Because he knew that in the end, all this land was his, since God had promised it to him, and he was willing to wait, humbly entrusting it in the Lord's hands. A number of passages come to mind as we jump ahead with that principle in mind to the New Testament and to the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. Think, for example, of what it says there in the famous Philippians 2 passage. Here Jesus, by right, deserved to be recognized as deity. Deserved to be honored and to enjoy all of the benefits of being fully God. But it says what? He just left it behind, and he humbled himself, and he became a man. In other words, he did not clutch onto what was rightfully his for the purpose of redemption. He just let it go. He was willing to trust. And Peter talks about the same thing, where he speaks of the Lord suffering the kind of mistreatment that he faced by the Jews, by the Romans, by the soldiers. He doesn't say a word. He just deals with it. He just accepts it, and he entrusts himself into the hands of the Lord, whom he knew would vindicate him in the end. Isaac apparently has learned a lesson like that, and he is willing to wait instead of fighting for his rights. And so he moves on at verse 22 and digs yet another well. And they did not quarrel over it, so he called its name Raboth, saying, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." And the word there in Hebrew has the idea of room or space, and so he names it, "I've got space now. I've got a place where nobody's going to bother me. I've got my own piece of property that God has provided with a well of water, and the Lord's going to prosper me in this place." Well, the tension still isn't totally resolved, because you still have questions, well, when is he going to get the others back? And these Philistines are still hanging around, and what's going to take place there? You can expect other problems to creep up along the way. But clearly, at this point in the story, the Lord has grown this man in his faith. So the tension is not entirely resolved, but his faith has been strengthened. And as he patiently waits for the Lord, God provides his need, and God gives him a spacious place. One scene left, but as we look back at this one, another word of application. This is coming from Ian Duguid. He says, Isaac was once more being put to the test. He was discovering that he, like his father before him, was nothing more than an alien and a stranger in the promised land. He was thereby forced to recognize that God's ultimate blessing upon him must rest in something other, something more than material prosperity. Far from the nations of the earth coming to bless themselves in his offspring, as God had promised in Genesis 26:4, the nations at present seem far more inclined to curse him as a nuisance. So first they're kicking him out of the land, and now they're fighting over his wells. And you're saying, what's this promise about the nations being blessed in you and everybody at peace and so forth? Well, that is so often the way of life in a fallen world, that kind of tension. Rich though Isaac was, there was still a wide gap between what God had promised and the reality that Isaac experienced, just as there had been for his father Abraham. He sees just enough of the promise fulfilled to encourage him, but there's a whole bunch that is not happening, and that looks next to impossible for it to ever happen. And there's this disconnect between the word and experience, and faith is what fills that gap between God's promise and what you're feeling and what you're going through at that time. That is a great lesson that this man learned. Well, moving on to the last scene to see how this all comes together. Scene 3 takes place in Beersheba. You see that name there in verse 23. From there he went up to Beersheba. And I'm calling this part blessing experienced. It really is a big advance in what he enjoys at this point. Blessing experienced by divine reversal. Let's read some of these verses. Blessing experienced by divine reversal. Once again, there's going to be a strong link with Abraham. In fact, this time it comes right from the mouth of God. Verse 24, the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not." Had he not been afraid before? Now the Lord is addressing that fear. "Fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. This time the link with Abraham is very strong, because it comes right from a statement that God makes saying, I am the God of Abraham, your father. Don't fear. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to bless you. And he brings up again the promise about the offspring. If you do connect this to the time frame, he had no children at this point. His wife was still barren. He is still praying and crying out to God to do this for him. And God assures him, you don't see anything happening yet. You're still waiting. I'm committed to doing this. It's coming. And Isaac, in another act of faith, like his father had done, built an altar at that point to indicate his commitment to God, to worship the Lord at that point. And things are looking up for him personally, but you're still wondering, what about these nations? How is this all going to be resolved? And once again, it's just amazing what the Lord does. Look at verse 26. When Ahimelech went to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, his advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And let me just stop there. The word Abimelech and the word Phicol, at least, seem to be not personal names, but titles or offices of people. And those same words, Abimelech and Phicol, come up in the life of Abraham in a very similar conversation where maybe the parents of these two here, or their predecessors in those offices anyway, were talking along the same lines to Abraham. Now they come to Isaac. Isaac says to them, why have you come to me, seeing that you hate me and have sent me away from you? I thought you guys wanted to get rid of me. I thought this was over. What's the deal? They said, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. Put your finger there and just back it up a few verses. And in verse 24, the Lord had said, fear not, for I am with you. And now the pagans are coming and they're saying, we see plainly the Lord has been with you. And what's the next statement? So we said, let there be a sworn pact between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done nothing to you, nothing but good, and have sent you away in peace. You are now blessed of the Lord. And if you back it up to that same verse 24, God has said, I am with you and will bless you. Now these people are coming and they're saying, we see plainly God has been with you and God has blessed you. And this isn't Isaac talking. These are, quote unquote, Gentile people who it's just inescapable. Something unusual is happening here. There's no way so quickly a stranger can prosper so much to where his crops grow a hundredfold, and he goes on to this valley, and everywhere he digs, there's a well coming out of there. What's the deal? There must be some supernatural power behind him. No other explanation. Now, it's a little hard to know their motives here. I tend to think they were just looking out for themselves because they're afraid that this man is going to get so powerful that he's going to attack them, take over their land, and so forth. And they seem a little less than honest when they say, we've done nothing to you but good and we sent you away in peace, when in fact they had kicked him out of there. But nevertheless, it is confirmatory that God is able to turn things around. Reference to Abraham's people and the nations. And that if in this one little scenario here, the Lord has been able to change the hearts of these people who were angry and hateful and rejecting of them, and to a certain extent had good reason to, because he had lied to them. And now they're basically at his feet begging, look, make a covenant with us because we don't want you to take us over. That is very encouraging, how God turned around this one situation, as you think about those grander promises that one day God would use Isaac's descendants to bring blessing to all nations. And the Bible in other places talks about the nations flocking into Israel and looking for peace. and seeking Israel's Messiah. And we're sitting here tonight as a part of the fulfillment of that, seeking our own salvation, seeking our own peace in Israel's Messiah as Gentile people. And even early on, Isaac is being shown in a very personal and dramatic way, God is able to turn the heart of the nations around. He's able to reverse things to where they're seeking you and they're looking for peace with you. Trust me, the rest of this covenant is going to be fulfilled. Maybe not in ways you might have imagined, and maybe not right away, but I'm committed to doing every last word of this promise. And so that night, verse 30, they have a feast, they eat and drink. In the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths, and Isaac sent them on their way, and they departed from him in peace. That same day Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they had dug, and said to him, "We have found water." He called it Sheba, therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. Now actually, Abraham had named that place Beersheba in the first place, and now kind of echoing that whole story, he picks up a very similar concept here. This time the word Sheba, meaning oath, Beersheba, well of the oath, and that ends up being remembered as the people of Israel go on enjoying that city in the future. Well, we're going to wrap this all up, but one more word of application about that section. Alan Ross has this to say. The only recourse for the Philistines was to seek peace and share the blessing. If believers were truly confident, like Isaac was, that God would supply all their needs, no matter what hostility they faced from the world, their proclamation of the faith would be far more substantive and convincing. In other words, here are these people, once Isaac got over the mistake that he made and just handed this all over to God and was trusting the promise, not fighting for his place anymore, just waiting on the Lord, what happened? It ends up resulting in blessing to where he has an attractive function, an attractive ministry toward the unbelieving. And the point would be, as the people of the world see that kind of consistent lifestyle coming from the people of God, instead of us being people who are filled with anxiety, people who are constantly worrying and looking for ways to deal with our needs, they're seeing this kind of restful trust in the promises of God. That cannot help but preach a sermon to them of the kind of peace they could enjoy, and that has this attractive influence on them. Well, let's try to package all this up together and summarize what we've seen tonight. This is very much of a transitional chapter in the whole story of Genesis. And it is a link between Abraham on the one hand and Jacob on the other. Isaac plays that kind of transitional role. The question we have to ask is, what does this have to do with the stories that came before about Abraham? And looking back, this is how I would put it, that it is unmistakable Isaac has fully inherited Abraham's blessing. God is giving him land. We already know God is going to give him children, and two. And we can see already how God is using him to have this impact on the nations. So Isaac has received these things. The blessing has been inherited by the second generation. Well, looking forward, as we think about what those chapters relate, what is it about immediately? The question is, all right, in the third generation, who's going to get it? When you look at chapter 27, and it's the story about Isaac swindling the blessing from Esau. Do you see the connection there? I put it in these terms. Whoever inherits Isaac's blessing, I mean, he got it from Abraham. Whoever inherits his blessing is really going to get it. I mean, this thing is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. God is serious about carrying this thing on, and it is growing generation after generation. So who is it going to be? Do you see why those boys are so intent on getting the blessing? Because they've seen how this is all worked out in God's providence in the life of their father. And they know this isn't just a normal, well, you know, parents trying to pass on good things to their kids. God is behind this. No wonder they're willing to do just about anything to get it, because they know this stuff is going to happen. Look at what God did for our father. Well, the end of the chapter, two verses we'll talk a little bit more about next time, are setting you up on a negative note as you go into that. Look at verse 34. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. I would say that those verses function as a transition to the stories about the next generation, and they started off on an ominous note. Things are not looking good for Isaac. And we're not going to justify what Jacob did, but it is apparent that Esau really is not committed to the ultimate purpose of this covenant. Because in fact, instead of maintaining the purity of the godly line and relating to the nations by way of, for a time now, living a distinctive lifestyle separate from them to be a testimony, he is bringing the godless into his home to where they're the ones that are now going to have the influence upon him. And he begins this whole problem of intermarrying with the heathen. And things are not looking good for him. This whole business about the blessing of the nations is going the other way. It's going the other direction with Esau. And it's preparing you to just say goodbye to Esau as far as this blessing is concerned, which is what's going to happen in the next chapter. But whatever happens, and before we get there, I think we need to acknowledge the wonderful proof that we have seen in this chapter, that sometimes in unexpected ways and always in spite of his people's failures, God is going to advance the blessing. We've seen that in Isaac's life, and I believe we see it in our lives even as we sit here tonight.